Very special guest in this hour, Sam Bush, the father of Newgrass, the father of Newgrass Revival. This year, 2020, finally, Newgrass Revival has been elected to the International Bluegrass Music Association Hall of Fame. Sam's going to discuss the beginning of the band, how the band got to this level, which he's very, very proud of. A lot to discuss. Great band. A lot of great musicians came through that band. And finally, all of them are going into the Hall of Fame. Thanks so much, Sam, for being available right on the cusp of this momentous occasion. Congratulations to everybody from Newgrass Revival. Congratulations to the members of IBMA who took this vote. And congratulations to Sam Bush, the father of Newgrass, no question about it. I'm really happy to welcome back to Unreal Bluegrass, Sam Bush. How you doing, Sam?
I'm great, Steve. It's a good day. I woke up.
It's a good day. Yeah, I mean, you know, honestly, in the time we're talking, in the period we're talking, that's a good thing, to wake up and be healthy.
Well, it really is. It's a blessing. And, of course, I think as we go through the pandemic, I think the whole country's feeling like we can't take anything for granted. And I'm just wondering if that I'm not alone and, maybe being more appreciative of the good things that happen for us.
Well, and there's more, you know, the good things will come back, I firmly believe. I don't know when. I don't know when normal's going to be normal again. You probably feel the same way. But I know this, it must be awfully hard for it. You are a road warrior type of performer. I mean, you love contact with the audience. And I've asked several. I want to get the Newgrass Revival in the Hall of Fame, IBMA. That's mm-hmm. me. But as you mentioned, the situation we're in, as a performer who's performed for so long and you have that contact with your band members and the audience, now it's just crickets. It's just silence.
Well, it is interesting. I found that you can do things virtually online every day if you want.
Yeah.
But of course I miss playing with an audience, and I think with an audience, I realized long ago that it's not the applause and the instant approval that I so much miss. I think it's the energy. It's the energy that when we're playing in the band, and that my band in this case, that it's this great circle of energy. Of course, it has to start with us, and when we feel like we're succeeding and having our circle of energy going, then it translates to the audience, and that comes back to us too.
Well, yeah.
And I've always been fortunate in this way that once we start playing on stage, my mind has really gone away from problems that we might have had that day, or just business or anything like that. That music overtakes me, and so in that way, I'm blessed that occurs, and that I can just relax and enjoy the moment of playing. So as we have gone through this period of not playing on stage together, Chris Brown, our drummer, and I were talking early into this. Now looking back, here we are at the time of this taping around Labor Day, and looking back to when it was now late April, and our last band job in 2020 was March 10th in Colorado. We were on a great little run out there. And that really what we were realizing is that this was the longest since we started learning to play our instruments. You know, what's one of the joys of learning to play? Well, playing with other people. You're excited about playing and you learn something new, and to get together with your buddy and share what you just learned, and then you kind of learn things together.
Yeah.
And maybe they knew a new phrase that you didn't know. And so we realized that's one of the things that we really missed, that we are missing, is that the getting together to share the music. And in our case, growing up as acoustic musicians primarily, mm-hmm. Of course I love playing on stage, but really our first love of music, especially growing up around bluegrass and what have you, is to, you know, for us to congregate and sit in a circle and play that way. And that is, and so even with my band, that's still some of our most joyful days, is sitting and, you know, working up tunes and practicing and hearing each other's instruments right off the instrument, because, you know, we don't really hear that on stage. That's a different format. And but just congregating and feeling that joy of playing together. And I've always been a person that loved, you know, to play in a group. And so that's what I was alluding to earlier, you know, playing online, you know, by myself.
Yeah, it's not the same.
Well, I don't knock myself out. And, you know, I've always felt like I can't think of anything to play if I'm not playing with other people. I bounce off of them. And so, for instance, we did the only thing we have done as a group was for the, you know, I've gone to Telluride Bluegrass Festival so long that the one thing we wanted to do was to make a virtual online show for Telluride.
Right.
During when their festival would have been this year.
Yeah.
And so we made a 75-minute set taped at the Station Inn here in Nashville. And it was such a joyful noise to get back together, just to play together. And Craig Ferguson, my good friend, that's the head of Planet Bluegrass, he had asked me, well, wasn't it sad without the fans? Well, of course it was different, but what we were going through at the time wasn't sadness. It was great joy of playing together. I said, no, man, I felt like I was back in the Beatles again. And so we got to do that together. And here just recently we practiced a song that I wanted to record, and now a week and a half ago, 2 weeks ago, went in the studio and recorded this one song. And so that was a whole different experience too, because you have to make sure that we are around Nashville. There's when people that really apply to, or excuse me, that, you know, comply to the rules of COVID and distancing and how we can do this. We went in the studio and recorded, and so basically, yeah, we're all in masks, and until I went in my certain little booth with my sliding door shut, then I could play and sing as we cut the track. And that was an incredibly joyful day. And so the joy of playing, playing together, is what all of us miss the most. And I'd say I'm speaking for a lot of
you, I think, you know, everyone that I've talked to since everything shut down, which is about the same time you experienced, you know, that becomes a topic on the show as we're talking about what they're doing. And some of their tours were blown out, horrible, you know, situation. But it comes down to that, not performing together or in front of an audience, and you get that immediate feedback. And I have to say, I hope everybody listening has seen Sam play with his band, because there's just you talk about a situation where the sum of the whole is greater than the parts by far. There's something happens when, and you mentioned it, Sam, you're on stage and you go somewhere and you're with your band and the audience is there, and it's almost like you're in a studio and you almost have a feedback loop, but it's a very pleasant, it just kind of builds and builds and builds, but nobody gets that horrible sound. The audience and you and the band and each member just keep building and building, and it's a wonderful thing. I can't wait to, you can't wait, I can't wait for you to get back out there again.
Oh, me too. It does give me energy. Well, we're going to do three socially distant shows just in a couple of weeks now, the 18th, 19th, and 20th of September. We're going to play, and, you know, one's like a drive-in show.
Yeah, I've heard of that.
There are two in Virginia, one in North Carolina. So, and we have to be, and of course, there are there's just things we, I mean, we have us and our manager and agents have come up with amongst artists they work with too, a 3-page COVID rider. And we, you know, for everyone's protection, for the venue's protection, for ours, but especially for the audience, you know, we don't, these are not going to be shows where people are just lined up in front of the stage with no masks on, spilling beer on each other. So we must, I've come up with my own quote, in order for the honor system to work, we must act with honor.
Oh, yeah. See, that's a doorway. That's a doorway type of thing as you're entering a palace or leaving a, that's going to last. That's going to be on somebody's mantle or something. I think that, I hope you copyright it so you can get to
Well, that. We are on our honor for each other.
Yeah. Sam, I'm always happy to speak with you. I love seeing you perform. Thanks for taking this time. So many things you've been on before, and we covered, man. I went back, it was 2014 on my website where I keep all these interviews, and we covered a lot of stuff, man. When you were learning, we covered Jethro, we covered everything. You know, we did it all. We covered Jean-Luc Ponty. I mean, we covered it all. So I don't want to redo that. But what I want to talk about, and the reason that I'm always happy to talk to you, enjoy it immensely. But this, the Newgrass Revival, and I told you off the air that when Newgrass Revival came into existence, was a perfect time for me and what I was looking for. And I put that early 70. But right now, the Newgrass Revival, which were sort of rocking the boat for so long, traditionalists, tremendous musicianship and the selections you were doing, now the whole band has been elevated to this International Bluegrass Music Association Hall of Fame. And I thought, just what an incredible trip and journey to come back around. And I wanted to know what you thought about it.
Boy, it really is, and it's kind of overwhelming. And when you can look up as an overview of things you used to do, right? And that we were now in the same class, with our. The people that we admired and looked up to, the Osbournes and the Dillards and the Country Gentlemen, and notice the ones I've just mentioned, because when I was a kid, we paid more attention to, I graduated from high school in 1970, so when I talk about teenage kids, and I was already playing in a band with Courtney Johnson then, I was just still in high school,
mm-hmm.
But we looked up to the people. The ones we looked up to the most were the ones that were the progressive groups within bluegrass format. And because, I grew up, I had the good fortune to grow up hearing Flatt and Scruggs on TV. And my dad, literally because we live within close proximity of WSM radio and television, my dad would wake me up and go to school each morning with the Flatt and Scruggs 15-minute radio show for Martha White.
No kidding.
And especially the fill and banjo number.
That
drove him crazy. He loved it. And so, already I had begun to take for granted Flatt and Scruggs and Stanley Brothers and Monroe even, that the ones that I grew up hearing. And I did get to grow up seeing Bill Monroe on TV and hearing him on the Grand Ole Opry every Friday or Saturday when we listened. And so so I was already way turned on by the Osbournes and Jim and Jesse, especially when Jim and Jesse did Berry Picking Time in the Country. It never occurred to me that they were the first bluegrass band to do an album of songs originally done by an African-American. Mm-hmm. I just, it was Chuck Berry. And just these, I just love the way they converted those songs to a bluegrass format. Another great album that was very influential to me was done, you don't hear a lot of people speak of it anymore, Beetle Country by the Charles River Valley.
Absolutely, yep.
And that just, man, what they did on that record, the way they, and they rearranged these Beatles songs and made them bluegrass. And the lead guitar playing of Eric Thompson, no, he wasn't a member of the band, but I met him at the fiddle contest in Weezer when I was a kid. Weezer, Idaho. And so I was so turned on, and the Dillards, you know, God, when the Dillards would come on Andy Griffith, it would just be this big freak out because I was already knew who they were, and my God, that's what they look like, and that's the Dillards.
Yeah.
So great. And the Country Gentlemen, and, you know.
And Sam, talking about the Dillards, you talk about a band that brought in other influences. You know, they were in that big they hit the colleges early because of their exposure in Hollywood, and they were doing Beatles tunes. And they did so many great things from so many different.
Well, they did a wonderful version of I've Just Seen a Spit.
Absolutely.
Sweet Straw Sweet.
Absolutely.
And the Dillards were the first, first that I heard, you know, use actual orchestration on a record with bluegrass instruments on Wheat Straw Sweet,
mm-hmm.
which I, you know, that and Copperfields, those two records that they made when Herb Peterson joined the band, they took a radical departure from where they were with Douglas. But to come back to the bluegrass boys,
yes, please.
We were and I remember when I saw Glenn Campbell and John Hartford, when they do their picking segment on the Glenn Campbell show, they did a bluegrass version of Great Balls of Fire, and I had a tape recorder jacked in my TV, and I used to tape all this cool stuff off TV. And Courtney, the solo that Courtney played on Great Balls of Fire, it was pretty much the one he learned the way John Hartford played it, with the chromatic lick and the whole thing in there. So now that the revival has been, you know, the official ceremony will be October 1st, it will be inducted.
Right.
I can just look back at it as the only guy that was in the band for 18 years, the whole 18 years, and look at the progression that we went through in that 18 years, and that's just the way we played, but there was a natural progression in our approach, in our style. We went from just playing rock and roll songs, converted to bluegrass, to, you know, writing our own tunes and making our own sound out of all our influences. And, you know, me growing up in the 60s, my influences were really wide. And as a high school rock guitar player and bass player in high school and bass player in the school orchestra on the upright bass. And you know, so I was a sponge for everything. Everything bluegrass-wise I loved. I loved almost everything rock and roll. And, you know, also got to see all the Beatles performances on Ed Sullivan, the Rolling Stones, Jeff Snare playing the Cream, Hendrix on TV on a rare occasion. And so all of that would lead into, and then when you gathered the four original members of the revival, you had all our different influences.
Yeah.
Curtis brought in this great dobroist, which was an instrument I really hadn't ever been out much to at all, hardly, until I met Curtis. And so he gave me a big education of dobro and what that was all about. And, you know, Courtney was a guy that came from the Stanley Brothers and became this very progressive player.
Yeah, really.
For his open mind of an old boy from high school Kentucky. He was the most open-minded person I ever knew. And so we just gathered it on from there. And then when John Callen joined our band, he brought in, he really sang more like Greg Allman when we first met. And he developed his own voice that started going with this bluegrass instrumentation that he hadn't been part of before. So in many ways, we all got our own voice in the band. And then when, you know, of course, when Bale and Pat joined, well, then that was a whole two other voices that was this great shot in the arm that we were ready for.
The whole band just kept...
evolution we went through.
Well, you just kept absorbing these sounds that came in and putting them to use in the band. The band, you know, things changed, personnel changed, but you just kept... everybody seemed to be... What you're saying now, what my belief was, that everybody was open to new sounds and new approaches to doing things. And in order to do that, though, Sam, each member of the band had to be like top level performer, top level musician, singer, and so you could bring those things in and make them what you wanted to. And I will say this from my personal point of view: Newgrass Revival was the band that finally something clicked in my mind. I'm a big jazz fan. And I realized that at the very level that Newgrass was playing, when you guys were really hitting it all, your mastery of the instruments, was equal to any jazz combo I'd ever heard, and you would play different things, but the facility that you had and the ability to hear it and play it as you're thinking it, it occurred to me that this is the equal of any great jazz combo I've ever heard in my life. And I still think that's where everything comes to. There's an apex between bluegrass and jazz. I think it started with Newgrass Revival, but, you know.
I don't think too many people would disagree with me that, you know, that bluegrass is the other great American improvisational music besides jazz.
Absolutely.
And because, I mean, especially, I mean, just you know, look at the history of Bill Monroe's band, and each time you get a different fiddle player, then things would sort of change. Banjo players, the same way of the way they would play, you know, just the solos on the songs or the instrumentals, and that it was their expression that was progressing that music, you know, the music not being written out. We're not following
exactly. The
format.
It's not
written out.
Mm-hmm.
So in that way, so much of it is improvised. It's just amazing. And, for instance, when Bela Fleck joined the band, okay, Courtney Johnson and I, before that, had always, us and John Hartford together, we were fans of John McLaughlin and the Mahavishnu Orchestra.
See, I knew we talked about this before, and I'm all over that.
And so when Bela joined, he hadn't really listened to John McLaughlin. He was more his jazz guy was Chick Corea. So, you know, he brought in a different slant on things and hit where his influences came from. And literally, that we, what, you know, John and I being more the Kentuckians, we brought in a guy from California and a guy from New York that joined the band. And that had its, you know, that made its, their influences were profound, and that made another mark for us.
You know, it's funny because and we talked about some of that before. I remember your connection with Jean-Luc Ponty, which was part of Chick Corea, which also came out of that whole John McLaughlin fusion sound.
Yes.
And we talked once about, I know that you played on stage with Return to Forever, or got to meet him. I forget exactly how that came about, but
I certainly never played with Return to Forever. I've been in the audience, I got to meet Jean-Luc actually. I think it was the year would have been '96 when for that year. I played 86 shows as an extra wheel with the Flecktones, and Bela was looking for. They were down to a trio, just Bela and the two Wooten brothers, after the departure of Howard Levy, and Bela wanted. They had played a year or two as a trio, and he wanted to bring back another voice, you know, where they were now repeating markets and stuff, give people a little something different to listen to, So it was great, man. I mean, boy, playing in the Flecktones. I mean, wow. And I really had to up my game. And I didn't play on every song, by the way. But, you know, I'd play on like 3/4 of the set. There's some tunes that they just got to do. But we opened, we were playing in, I think, somewhere in Canada. And Jean-Luc was in town playing with the just a trio of Al Dineal and him and Stanley Clark, maybe. And at any rate, Jean-Luc came in the club, and I just freaked out because I'd never dreamed of meeting Jean-Luc and loved his playing since I happened. The music store I worked at when I was a kid got Downbeat Magazine, and I'd read about him, and I got his first record called Sunday Walk.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, you know, an amazing experience, and always love Jean-Luc. And so at any rate, I got to meet him, and then next day I happened to get to ride the elevator down with him. And so, you know, it was just so overwhelming for me. And so he remembered the meeting, and well, I mean, he heard me play some that night, and I did play the fiddle, and I didn't know I was playing the fiddle in front of Jean-Luc. If I had, I'd have probably been too nervous to note the thing. But years later, now the trio of Stanley Clark and Bela Fleck now instead of Al D. Mill, and Jean-Luc played at Telluride. And so Jean-Luc, I got to connect with him again at the Telluride Bluegrass, and he and I had worked up, me and the band had worked up his tune New Country, trying to follow his arrangement of it as closely as possible. And Newgrass Revival played New Country in our latter years.
Oh, I remember.
We had actually rearranged it a little bit and tried adding some different parts or something. At any rate, now my band did it. We just tried. We had Chris Brown on drums, so we could do it just like John Luke's version. And so I asked him if he'd like to set in. And he just wasn't sure. He hadn't slept much. And, you know, and he said he hadn't played that tune in years, didn't know. And so I said, well, there's a slot in our set where we can do it. So if you find yourself, you know, want to come back over at the festival and you want to, you know, love you to play. If not, I'll do a different instrumental. I'm not going to play it without you. And so, you know, we're playing our set, and all of a sudden my wife, Lynn, comes out and tells me, and we're only a couple of tunes away from where that slot would be. She goes, Jean-Luc's here, and he wants to play New Country.
Did she actually whisper? Like, did she whisper like that?
Well, it was, yeah. It was
hush, kind of hush.
Between songs.
Yeah, okay.
Says in my ear, and you know, it's like getting pulled over at 90 miles an hour in a 45 zone. The heart leapt up into the chest. Oh no! And so, at any rate, I'm glad I didn't know before the set that he was going to play with us again. I'd have been preoccupied and too nervous. And Manny came on, and we just had a great. It was a wonderful experience. And so then, after that, I was recording a record, and I wanted us to see if Jean-Luc could do that. And it wasn't matching up at first, just any way to schedule it or how it could be done. And Jean-Luc, the bottom line was, called up and said, "Yeah, if you send the track to my studio," or I communicated through his manager, and then we communicated through email. I think the first email I ever sent was to Jean-Luc, and everybody that knows me knows I don't send many emails. I like to talk on the phone, and so we recorded our track, and it was sent to Jean-Luc, and he overdubbed his part in his studio in France, and I walked in the studio, and the engineer Dave Cinco said, "You want to hear Jean-Luc's part?" I went, "You have it." Yeah, and so, man, when I sat down and heard Jean-Luc's part, you know, tears of joy just sprang out. And so, you know, never dreaming that would happen. And I guess I got sidebar.
No. Listen, that's cool because people listen to Unreal Bluegrass. I'm talking to Sam Bush, ostensibly we were talking about Newgrass Revival's Elevation and Hall of Fame, but there's going to be side things like that, and don't let me distract you too much, but since you mentioned that music was Jean-Luc, I saw you with Emmylou Harris a long time ago, and so the set was progressing, it was all really comfortable stuff. My wife went with me, and it was a concert with the Zoo, at the Zoo, Cincinnati.
Oh, yeah, okay.
It was a great day outside, and a nice long concert, and she left for a minute. And then, and during a break, you started playing, which I recognize as being something derivative of or inspired by Jean-Luc. So, these were festival seating, okay? I mean, it was just chairs out at a Zoo,
yeah.
A Zoo thing. So I tell my wife, I said, "Here, hold on a second. We can move down because people were there to see Emmylou, and when you started, and I loved it, man. But you know, but I got an upgrade in my seat when you started that middle session, and then she came back out."
Yeah, she must let us do Lee Highway Blues, and I would turn on my echo.
That's exactly there. Thank you. That's what it was.
Because Jean-Luc had a few different things over the years on his records for just him with his Echoplex.
Yeah. But I absolutely dug it, man. And my wife was happy because when Emmylou came back out, we were about 4 rows away.
There you go. Yeah.
So I always wanted to thank you for that, but I just never had the opportunity. So
glad it worked out.
Well, yeah, I appreciate the sacrifice. Listen, so we start talking about
Newgrass. Glad I could give people a chance to go to the beer line when I played.
Well, so Newgrass Revival really is from 71 through. You did this whole thing with Leon Russell, which, and I have those recordings also. I drop in the show every once in a while when I find the opportunity. But the influences you drew, you've talked about the influences to you, the influences to the band, other members brought in. And now after all this time, when was the last time, I think you mentioned off the air, was it last time you actually played together with Newgrass Revival was, 30? Did you say 30 years?
Well, our last show ever was New Year's Eve, 1989.
Okay.
And we opened for the Grateful Dead in the Oakland Coliseum. So we had been trying to get on that show for years and had been close to getting on it. That was like the big rock show of America to get to play on that Dead show on New Year's Eve. And then upon hearing we were breaking up, then, you know, Jerry Garcia, of course, a bluegrass fan, and aware of us and a fan of Bayless, reached out there, you know, had Dead's management reach out to us. Now they wanted us. So it was crazy the way it worked out. Our last show was originally December 16th in Nashville here. We went into Nashville. Got to play a good long show. So I know we went to California. And by the way, I actually had to dicker it out with the price with Bill Graham himself in order for him to pay for the gig to pay enough for us to go and not lose money on it.
Yeah.
And because that's the life of the front band. you didn't really need a front band on that show. It didn't draw more people for us to be there. But the show was we started I think at 8 o'clock, and we played 45 minutes, and then Bonnie Raitt played. And then the Dead came on, and of course they played through midnight, where they ring in the new year and everything. And they played a good long show, so it was we were hoping it would be a good experience, and so it really was. The band played great, and we caught the audience before all their drugs kicked in, so we got a good audience response.
You got a legitimate, you got a real pull from the audience there, wasn't it?
We had definitely been warned, you know, backstage, do not drink anything you don't personally open. So, I mean, that's reality here.
And now, Sam, you got that backstage, and now you got a COVID rider. How the times have changed.
Woof, no kidding. Wouldn't it be great if every band, when you knew that was your last gig, you get to play on the best show in America that night?
Yeah.
So that was really, and a funny thing to me, over the years, I don't know why people somehow could mispronounce Newgrass Revival, but they did. And then our band introductions. And the very first band introduction I ever remember us having as Newgrass Revival, we were working at Bean Blossom for the Sunday afternoon. This is, you know, not the Bean Blossom Bluegrass Festival, but, Birch Monroe, Bill's brother, ran the park, Birch and their sister Bertha, who liked us and would hire us to come play the Brown County Jamboree. And you play an afternoon matinee, and then you play again, I think, at 7 that night. So you do two sets. I think the matinee would be about 3, maybe o'clock, maybe. And Birch Monroe was the first that I recall to introduce us, and he called it, "Ladies and gentlemen, the Bluegrass Revival Boys." or he might have called us, I think it might have been the Newgrass Revival Boys.
Well,
so he added the boys to us.
That's not too
and
bad.
Then that, so then for our very last show, Bill Graham himself, rock and roll Hall of Fame promoter, Bill Graham introduced us, and he must have thought he had it wrong or something, because he went, "Ladies and gentlemen, from Nashville, the Newgrass Bluegrass Revival." And you can hear me and John Cowan just go,
"Wah!" Circle of life. It came back to the same, almost the exact same thing with the
full circle.
Yeah.
From the first one and the last
that's
one.
That's hysterical.
So, I loved it. I just thought that's perfect. Perfect cap.
You couldn't ask for better. And here's the question I have to ask, and we've hit all around it, and this incredible feeling now, and of finally reaching that. Not that you were always like, we want to get there, but it's great to finally be acknowledged of the great influence of Newgrass Revival and all the iterations. But in 71, when you were starting this, is this something that ever occurred to you? I mean, that you would be into these Hall of Fames? I mean, I just, you knew you were doing what you enjoyed. Maybe that's the key to it. But now looking back, it still must be, how do we connect the dots to get here?
No, there was never any thought of that. And not to mention, there wasn't any such thing.
Well, I know. I mean, that's why I didn't.
When we first started, you know, by the way, bands like us or bluegrass groups, folk groups, acoustic groups especially, our jobs would be, you know, to play in a club 4 or 5 nights a week. I mean, that's what you did. One-nighters, are you kidding? There's no such thing. And our one-nighters were going the reward of playing all winter in the clubs and then getting to go to a festival. Going to festivals, that in the summertime, man, was that a big reward. And not only to get to go and hear the other bands, but to go where an audience was listening to us. You know, I mean, you're as Mitch Jane and the Dillard said, you're up there swatting it out with bluegrass instruments, playing to a room full of people that your job is to sell alcohol. And, you know, and you're part of the attraction. You're in a bar. And you know, the attraction that gets people there, but if we, you know, they don't support the bar,
you don't get to come back.
A place to play.
That's right.
And so, no, there was no such thing. So, you know, when the IBMA started, that's where it's like just for them to start the organization of the International Bluegrass Music Association, that was like the first like validation that how far, you know, Bill Monroe's music had come in the world of show business and respect. And, you know, bluegrass wasn't just country music's little red-headed stepchild anymore. And so that's what changed it. I mean, really, you know. Bluegrass finally started getting some respect. And now, ironically, when we were first getting going, you know, it was a common phrase as people come up to us, you know, and saying, that ain't bluegrass.
Yeah.
And our response was always, we know. Yeah. And your point is?
Yeah, skip on down the page.
And that, too, would be in the perception of the audience. In other words, if we were playing for a bluegrass audience, as far as they were concerned, we were a rock band. I mean, even with our original four, Ebo, Courtney, and Curtis and I.
Mm-hmm.
And then when we, for instance, got this incredible job in 1973 for 2.5 months opening for Leon Russell on the biggest rock tour in America, you could average it out to 25,000 people a night. It was pretty terrifying at first. And to them, what do you think Leon Russell's rock and roll audience saw? They saw a bluegrass band.
Yeah.
You know, so that too was could sometimes be in the perception of the audience member. And so we always thought, and I believe we succeeded in this, that one of our things that we could contribute to bluegrass music was that, okay, people, and it's been said many times, when people would say, well, you know, I never really liked bluegrass, but I like you guys. And then we could say, well, if you like us, you like some of these songs, you should go back and listen to the original versions that we learned them from. So we'd like to think that we helped turn people onto, you know, Flat and Scruggs,
Bill Monroe,
and the Stanley Brothers,
yep,
and Reno and Smiley. And although Reno and Smiley, to me, were very progressive in their nature, they were always a little more progressive.
You know, all of them were when you really listen to some. Like, you know, the Osmond Brothers, when you listen to some of Sonny's playing,
oh my goodness,
it's like nobody can do that now, and he was doing things that were, I mean, he was so far ahead, and Bobby's mandolin playing always kind of gets overlooked because his voice was unearthly.
And one of the greatest records when I was growing up for me and very influential was the Osborne Brothers instrumental album.
Mm-hmm.
So they made an instrumental album, and Bobby Osborne was the first bluegrass mandolin player that I had heard, because Bill Monroe didn't religiously follow the fiddle melody when playing a fiddle tune the way Bob Osborne did. So, you know, Bobby, I was listening intently to the Osborne Brothers bluegrass instrumental album. And then, Steve, recently there's been a re-release of the movie Bluegrass Country Soul.
Yeah.
And when you see the Osborne Brothers in that movie, they really spell it out who was the most progressive and who was the most far-out band of that time.
They were. Them. They were. And
they're Bobby plays his echo, turns his echo plex on the mandolin for his solo on Listening to the Rain. And hearing Sonny Osborne's six-string banjo playing behind Bobby on Ruby, Are You Mad?
Yeah.
Is one of the greatest moments ever in the history of bluegrass music for me.
Yeah.
And the way Sonny was playing, there's one of your most influential banjo players that ever lived, Sonny Osborne.
So the Osbournes.
And they had Robbie, Bobby's son, back on a kick drum and a snare. And Jimmy Martin in the same movie has Timmy Martin on snare drum. So for what is 40 years later, for anyone to be surprised if Sam Bush Band has a drummer, come on.
Yeah, really.
You know? But listen to the Flattened Scruggs.
I know.
They had a snare drum on it. I mean, one of the few that never incorporated a drum was Bill Monroe. And he didn't think it agreed with his stringed instruments. Peter Rowan and I have talked about that. It wasn't that he didn't like drums. He just didn't think they agreed with his instruments and didn't really need it. They didn't need it. Bluegrass Revival, we used drummers on records, but we felt like we had it under control on
live.
Our live show.
Yeah.
It was much more enjoyable just the four of us without that on our live shows.
Sam, you lived through when all these original creators of what was labeled bluegrass were still very vital and still walking around and performing, and it's that connection with that first generation that you speak to now.
It was all brand new. I got to go to the first Roanoke Bluegrass Festival in 1965. I was 13 in the audience, and I was seeing all these things. And then in 66, the Country Gentlemen came, and they really blew the lid off.
Yeah, they did.
But I got to see, you know, Doc Watson in 65, and Reno and his band, Smiley and his band, they'd already split up. Clyde Moody. You know, and one of the important things that they did in Roanoke 65 was Carlton Haney, the promoter, would have what he called the Bluegrass Story. And on Sunday afternoon, now Bill Monroe's band was at that time in 65. It was James on bass, James Monroe, Bill, Pete Rowan on guitar, a left-handed banjo player named Don Lineberger, Gene Wollinger on the fiddle.
Yeah.
The next year in '66, he had Lamar Greer on banjo and Richard Green on the fiddle. And
boy, had that
ante been up.
Yeah.
And but anyhow, on that on the Sunday afternoon, what an education for a young kid like me to watch, because I did not know that any of this, or you know, the history of the people who had played with Bill Monroe, who had gone on to have their own music after playing with him. And it started that day, so they started the set. I think Bill and his current band played a couple tunes, and then it started paring down, and then the first thing that happened was that Clyde Moody come out and sang Six White Horses with Bill, just like they did pre-banjo, before the Bluegrass Boys had a banjo player. And then, you know, and Mac Wiseman, of course, is there. So then, you know, obviously Flattened Scruggs were not there. So then Mac Wiseman. And then with Mac, you know, and then Don Reno played the banjo on some of. So all these people. And at one point, a very young Sonny Osborne had played, 16 years old, had played with Monroe.
Mm-hmm.
And so then to watch the progression of people that had played with Monroe keep building up his music up finally to the end, back to his current day band. It was like the bluegrass story. And well, Jim, of course, Jimmy Martin was there. So Jimmy Martin was a large part of this sound that came after Mack Wiseman. And so I got to see, it was like this, it was the bluegrass story.
It was a graduate course.
Yeah. And heck, I didn't, you know, it, I mean, it all made sense where all this came from. And the, one of the points I guess I'm going to get to is that I saw a friend of mine wrote a tune once that he wanted, a mallet picker, and he wanted played it for Bill, and he wrote it so it could be just like a Bill Monroe tune, and it was, and so he played it, and Monroe said at the end, "Well, that's real good. Now, what can you do on your own?" And I took that to mean that he loved it when people played his music, but he expected you to get your own. He did.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, he sure didn't sound like the string band music of what else was on the Grand Ole Opry in 1940-45.
No, sir.
He didn't sound anything like the Fruit Jar Drinkers and the Possum Trotters. And you know, he totally changed it. Bill Monroe made the first hillbilly jazz. And by the way, if you hear me say Monroe, I try to say it like that because he personally corrected me once.
Okay.
I said Mr. Monroe, and he said, "It's Monroe."
Monroe.
So,
well, you know,
that was when I was like 40 years old. He said that to me.
That's you're still young enough to learn. You know, he hired. I'm going to finish up here with Sam Bush.
I hope so.
I'm going to finish up with Sam Bush. I appreciate you being available. Really, we're musing now, but we were talking about Newgrass Revival. But talking about Bill Monroe, hired a banjo player by the name of Bill Keith.
Yeah.
I mean, how out of the box was that?
Well. Totally, and when he got Bill Keith, Richard Green, I mean Peter Rowland was like a more progressive thinking guitarist and singer than you know that came after Del McCoury, right?
Right.
And so then it went back and at that 66 Roanoke Festival, I got this guy that came. They unearthed a guy that hadn't played the fiddle for years and went back to coal mining from Jenkins, Kentucky, and that's where Kenny Baker came back on the scene. And then lo and behold, a couple of years later, he took Byron Berline's place in Bill's band and started playing with Bill. And then Kenny went back to setting the gold standard of fiddle players that played with Bill Monroe.
Well, you know, the point in this is my editorial. Which I think you support, maybe not. I don't want to put words in your mouth, but bluegrass was never a photograph. It was never a static moment. It was always developing, and you've talked about those through Bill, and it still is. It was with Newgrass Revival, and it still is now. It never was, and I think sometimes people think what they saw first was what it should be, but it was never that still photograph. It was never that black and white photograph. It was always evolving from all sources.
Yeah, and it isn't just bluegrass. Style music. I think other types of music are that way too. You know, the country should be this, jazz should be this. But in terms of Newgrass Revival, you know, it's great to have a place in all this. And you know, I think the threat to traditionalists at the time was that they were afraid all bluegrass music would turn towards what we were doing. No, that certainly hasn't happened.
No.
Yes, there are many that you can hear influences of Newgrass Revival in young bands today, as well as I really hear a lot of influence by J.D. Crowe in the New South in a lot of young bands, especially on like the bluegrass digital channels on radio and then the great thing is that we still have Del McCoury out there kicking it hard.
Yeah.
And a lot of people are now influenced more to play more Monroe-style stuff, whether they even know it or not, because they're playing like the Del McCoury band.
That's just it. And so then you got Del in the band, then you got the Traveling McCoury's who do something totally other.
And you know, it's not accidental that, you know, these teenage, when Newgrass Revival would play in Pennsylvania, these two teenage boys with big smiles on their faces all the time named McCurry would come to see us, and Ronnie and Rob McCurry would come here, Newgrass boys. Dale couldn't come. He was working. He had to get up early. And I don't think Ronnie would mind if I said that there's a Newgrass Revival influence in the Traveling
Band. Absolutely.
But they're their own people, and I love the Traveling McCurrys. Me and my band did some shows with them last year as a co-bill, and it was really fun because we would band together, both bands, at the end and play for another half an hour. They're far-reaching in their thought pattern. And so's Dale. He's just defined it within the style of what he likes to do and how to do it. And it's really great that Ronnie and Rob are there to help Dale, you know, along with his vision that still exists.
Yeah. Wow, what a blast. I'm so excited, Sam Bush. I'm so excited for the band, for the recognition again for Newgrass Revival. So glad you're
here.
It's a huge deal. It's a huge deal.
From a kid on a tobacco and cattle farm in Bowling Green, music has opened my eyes, and I've gotten to see the world figuratively and literally in body. So it's great.
Well, congratulations. Thanks so much for your time to kind of meander up and around that point. I know we went on some little eddies there, but that's part of my doings. I apologize. But also there's just things to fill out along the way.
Well, it's like the Dillard's, right? The roots and branches. There's a whole lot of them in this tree of within the
right.
Big tree of bluegrass music.
That's right. Well, man, congratulations again, Sam, on Newgrass Revival. Everything they've meant to me personally and everybody else also. And now you are an industry standard. Now you're up there
wow.
with you're up there with the guys you used to go see and just fascinate.
And that is a pretty gratifying and kind of overwhelming thought. You know, what are we doing? What are we doing here?
Yeah.
We just hung in. We hung in there. But yeah, it's a credit to the music we made that it's now been 30 years since we played, and people were still giving it airplay and amazing that you hear me say it, but yeah, the youngsters have carried on this Newgrass style.
Those young kids.
I love it.
Get off of my grass. That would be a name for an album, huh?
And it ain't, and the great thing about it is it ain't just good old boys anymore.
No.
Look at the amazing amount of talent we have, female bluegrass style pickers and artists, singers, of course, my favorite, if not my favorite, young mandolin player right now is Sierra Holt.
Oh, sure.
I'm so proud of her, she's just,
And she's
the music's in really good hands with these great young players.
And she's going different places too.
Of course she is,
yeah.
She should. I mean, I think I'm glad I grew up in the '60s because I only had a TV and a tape recorder and some records to learn off of. I think my head would be spinning around not knowing which direction. There's so much to learn from these days. So it's a good time for music.
It's great. Thanks so much, Sam Bush. I really enjoy it. It's been 6 years. We got to find an opportunity to talk about more stuff down the road for sure.
Well, we will. I'll have a new record coming out either late this year or early next year.
There you go. There's a little secret plug in there. We'll wait for that, and then I'll catch you on that one, too.
Great, Steve.
Hey, Sam, thanks so much, man.
My pleasure.
Bye-bye.
Thank you always.
There he is, Sam Bush. Thanks so much. I can't say that enough, to take the time to get into this whole issue with now bringing Newgrass Revival into the IBMA, International Bluegrass Music Association, Hall of Fame. It's a big deal, just like Sam says, and it's absolutely deserved. One more tune then from Newgrass Revival. You're going to hear I'm Down. Thank you for tuning in. By the way, I think it's the audience of Unreal Bluegrass and the respect that artists have for the art for the audience that makes Sam Bush available to me or to Unreal Bluegrass at this point, so we can get right on top of the issue as they're going into the Hall of Fame. So thanks, Sam. Thanks for everybody that helped arrange that. And thanks to every one of you that listens to Unreal Bluegrass.